America.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. As the war in Ukraine wages on, the owner of Russia's Wagner Group military contractor claims that his troops have extended their gains in the Ukrainian stronghold of Bakhmut. Flashpoint Ukraine contributor Anna Shinnikova tells VOA Steve Kirsch that UN Chief Antonio Guterres met with the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and discussed two primary topics.
According to what President Zelensky and Antonio Guterres said after their meeting, the grain deal should be prolonged because 18th of March is the deadline of this current agreement. So this discussion was one of the main priorities and one of the main topics. And another main topic, according to President Zelensky, was a question of the security.
Meanwhile, European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell said on Wednesday that he suggested the bloc spend 1 billion euros for the joint procurement of ammunition for Ukraine and refill their own stockpiles. More from VOA's Diane Roberts.
Borrell was speaking to reporters after a meeting of EU defense ministers in Stockholm.
If we go together, we can reduce not only unit prices, but also we can reduce the delivery time. And the European Peace Facility can support these efforts for the benefit of Ukraine.
Borrell said there was general agreement on jointly buying munitions at the meeting, but added that there were still questions outstanding and details to be discussed. Officials warned Ukraine is burning through shells faster than its allies can make them, prompting a renewed search for ammunition and ways to ramp up production. Diane Roberts, VOA News.
The leaders of U.S. intelligence agencies said on Wednesday China's deepening its cooperation with Russia to try to challenge the United States despite international condemnation of the invasion of Ukraine. This is VOA News. As parts of southeast Turkey struggle to recover from last month's earthquake, many are questioning why so many relatively modern buildings collapsed in the 7.8 magnitude tremor, with some engineers pointing the finger at government policy, as VOA's Henry Ridgewell reports.
Survivors describe buildings liquefying as the tremors hit, each floor collapsing onto the next. Why did some buildings survive relatively unscathed while others collapsed? Hasan Aksungu is chairman of the Chamber of Civil Engineers in the city of Adana, close to the earthquake zone.
Geriye.
He told VOA the fact that the buildings next to those collapsed buildings, which were exposed to the same impact, were not demolished, shows that either the design, the implementation, or the control stages of these collapsed buildings were broken.
That is VOA's Henry Ridgewell reporting. U.S. President Joe Biden and his upcoming budget proposal aims to cut deficits by nearly $3 trillion over the next decade. At a news conference, the White House press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, says the budget plan and resulting deficit cut is part of a statement of values.
This is something that we think is important. This is something that shows the American people that we take this very seriously. When we think about the fiscal responsibility, when we think about how do we move forward, not just for Americans today, but for Americans, other generations that are going to be coming behind us.
The deficit to reduction goal is significantly higher than the $2 trillion that Biden had promised in his State of the Union address last month. It is also a sharp contrast with the House Republicans, who called for a path to a balanced budget, but have yet to offer a blueprint. The president's package is unlikely to pass the House or the Senate as proposed. Americans who officials say got caught in a deadly drug cartel shootout in Mexico last week all had ties to a small town in South Carolina, where leaders have been calling for community support of the families and two captives returned to U.S. soil on Tuesday. It's a major international mystery with global consequences who was behind the explosions that damaged the Nord Stream gas pipelines last year in the Baltic Sea. The answer could threaten Western unity over backing Ukraine and defending itself from Russia's invasion. It could also shatter Russian and Chinese attempts to fix the blame on a hypocritical West, as they put it. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Today is Thursday, March 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinua Adofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, U.S. spy chief warns of deepening ties between Russia and China over the Ukraine war.
Chinese Communist Party, or CCP, under President Xi Jinping, will continue efforts to achieve Xi's vision of making China the preeminent power in East Asia and a major power on the world stage.
Rallies marking International Women's Day take place around the world as the UN calls for rights protections.
Takes on even greater significance at a time when women's rights are being abused, threatened, and violated around the world. Progress, won over decades, is vanishing before our eyes.
A UN report warns of, quote, gross human rights violations fueled by pervasive impunity, unquote, in South Sudan. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. The leaders of U.S. intelligence agencies said on Wednesday that China is deepening its cooperation with Russia to try to challenge the United States, despite international condemnation of the invasion of Ukraine. They also identified Beijing as the principal threat to the U.S. around the world. Director of National Intelligence Agency Avery Haines told lawmakers at a hearing of the Senate Intelligence Committee that China will continue to intimidate rivals in the South China Sea and will build on actions from 2022, which could include more Taiwan Strait crossings or missile overflights of Taiwan.
China, which is increasingly challenging the United States economically, technologically, politically, and militarily around the world, remains our unparalleled priority. Chinese Communist Party, or CCP, under President Xi Jinping, will continue efforts to achieve Xi's vision of making China the preeminent power in East Asia and a major power on the world stage. To fulfill Xi's vision, however, the CCP is increasingly convinced that it can only do so at the expense of U.S. power and influence, and by using coordinated whole-of-government tools to demonstrate strength and compel neighbors to acquiesce to its preferences, including its land, sea, and air claims in the region and its assertions of sovereignty over Taiwan. In brief, the CCP represents both the leading and most consequential threat to U.S. national security and leadership globally, and its intelligence-specific ambitions and capabilities make it, for us, our most serious and consequential intelligence rival. During the past year, the threat has been additionally complicated by a deepening collaboration with Russia, which also remains an area, obviously, of intense focus for the intelligence community. The Russians are making incremental progress on Bakhmut, which is not a particularly strategic objective, but are otherwise facing considerable constraints, including personnel and ammunition shortages, dysfunction within the military's leadership, exhaustion, as well as morale challenges. And even as the Russian offensive continues, they are experiencing high casualty rates. Putin is likely better understanding the limits of what his military is capable of achieving and appears to be focused on more modest military objectives for now. In short, we do not foresee the Russian military recovering enough this year to make major territorial gains, but Putin most likely calculates that time works in his favor and that prolonging the war, including with potential pauses in the fighting, may be his best remaining pathway to eventually securing Russia's strategic interests in Ukraine, even if it takes years.
That's U.S. Director of National Intelligence, Avery Haines. Rallies marking International Women's Day took place around the world on Wednesday. This after a year in which girls in Afghanistan were banned from education, mass women's rights protests erupted in Iran, and a landmark U.S. abortion ruling was overturned. Demonstrations were held in Paris, Berlin, Beirut, Jakarta, Singapore, and elsewhere. Rallies were planned in other cities. Abortion and reproductive rights were on the agenda for international rallies 9 months after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the landmark 1973 Roe v. Wade ruling that recognized women's constitutional rights to abortion. U.S. Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
The session of the Commission on the Status of Women is one of the most important annual events at the United Nations. And it takes on even greater significance at a time when women's rights are being abused, threatened, and violated around the world. Progress, won over decades, is vanishing before our eyes. In Afghanistan, women and girls have been erased from public life. In many places, women's sexual and reproductive rights are being rolled back. In some countries, girls go to school, risk kidnapping and assault. In others, police prey on vulnerable women they have sworn to protect.
That's UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. The United Nations marked Women's Day under the theme, quote, Digital, unquote, Innovation and Technology for Gender Equality. In several African countries, far less girls attend schools than boys due to a number of factors, including cultural norms and a lack of education funding. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell recently accompanied First Lady Jill Biden to a 5-month trip to Namibia and Kenya. She sat down with VOA's Carol Van Dam to talk about Biden's effort to encourage more families to send their girls to schools.
This was a whirlwind trip. We had on average 3 events a day. We did not rest at all on this trip. There was no stopping. And what she said were some of the usual things. Women and girls should be empowered. They should have an education. These are universal values that we all expect and we all, I think, generally agree on. And the problem is this does still need to be said in so many parts of the world. And to have a powerful, prominent, educated American woman saying that, that has to count for something because it's not the priority necessarily of the Biden administration. They're much more national security focused. So this is the other side. This is the yin to the yang. And I've never personally understood why we view them in those terms because I don't understand that some might say that she took on soft issues and she has no enforcement. She has no actual real power. But what is more powerful than being able to care for your family? What is more powerless than looking your kid in the eye and saying, I can't feed you today?
Exactly.
You know, so she highlighted that. I thought.
And Dr. Biden talked about the need to hear from African voices on all kinds of things, especially climate change and economic inequality. Talk a little bit more about that.
So first of all, she reiterated a Biden administration policy change, which is that the Biden administration is now pushing for African nations to have more say at the UN. And also at the G7 and G20 fora. And this is actually important because this is something that African nations have been clamoring for a long time. By just repeating that stance and kind of normalizing it and making it now kind of the accepted stance of the Biden administration, she drew attention to the actual hard power that the Biden administration wants to see African countries have. But in terms of hearing from African voices, she spoke to a range of people on this trip. She spoke to young people. She spoke to women. She memorably spent 36 minutes under a tree in a rural part of Kenya talking to women about how they are coping with this drought that has caused unprecedented crisis in Kenya, which is, you know, a middle-income flourishing democracy.
They say 4 consecutive years, hardly any rainfall.
We're getting to 4 consecutive years. I think it's been 3 so far, and it looks like this is going to be year 4.
Right. So back to education. She's a teacher. Millions of girls in several African countries, like South Sudan, do not go to school. The government has made efforts to turn that around, but cultural norms are still very, very prominent in these countries. And girls are just not encouraged by their families to attend school. Did she talk about that in particular?
She did not bring up South Sudan in particular. I just want to stress that. Not only did she talk about the role that education plays in the lives of young women and how they can go on to impact society, but just the fact of her being there as an educator who has made this her life's work. As you know, 8:30 on Tuesday and Thursday mornings, she is Dr. Biden teaching at a class at a community college, I want to say 20 miles from where we are right now.
In the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area.
Exactly. So she not only talked about that, but she kind of showed that by being an educator, she's truly, this is her life's work.
That's VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam. An investigation by a group of human rights experts find tens of thousands of civilians in South Sudan are terrorized and traumatized by widespread gross human rights violations fueled by pervasive impunity. The latest report by the 3-member UN Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan came under review by the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
In presenting the report, Commission member Andrew Clapham told the Council that words cannot fully express the horror and totality of ongoing atrocities perpetrated against the people of South Sudan.
Since we last addressed this Council in March 2022, our team has documented further gross human rights violations throughout the country, including widespread and horrific attacks against civilians and state-sponsored extrajudicial killings. Sexual violence against women and girls remains systematic, and the use of children by state forces and non-state armed groups continues.
The commission documented what it said was a well-planned and devastating operation in Lear County. It said government officials there directed militias to carry out widespread killings, rape, and forced displacement against civilians considered to be loyal to the opposition. The commission has gathered evidence of other government-inspired military operations carried out in Tonj North and Mayom counties. Clapham said the commission found the escalation of violence in Upper Nile State particularly alarming.
In Upper Nile, civilians were again targeted by multiple armed groups with competing political agendas in a quest for territorial control. Survivors recounted moving from village to village, pursued by attackers who killed and raped civilians based on their ethnic affiliation.
Clapham said those responsible for atrocities must be investigated and brought to justice. Unfortunately, he noted that the government has carried out only one actual investigation, though it has announced the establishment of different special investigative committees to examine these four situations. South Sudan's Minister of Justice, Ruben Madola Roll, was not impressed. He said the commission's report was full of inaccuracies and contradictions. He said the methodology used by the commission was profoundly flawed and contained recycled allegations from previous reports dating back to 2013. He said human rights in this country were progressing, noting the government had ratified several important human rights conventions and has fully implemented the action plan for the armed forces on addressing conflict-related sexual violence in South Sudan. He accused the commission of undermining the sovereignty of South Sudan and called on the council not to renew its mandate. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In other news, a Nigerian judge on Wednesday refused a request by one opposition candidate who lost last month's presidential election to stop the electoral body from reconfiguring a voting system for state elections. Opposition challenger Peter Obi of the Labour Party said the reconfiguration will destroy the evidence for his case after he lost the presidential election to the candidate of the ruling All Progressives Congress Party, Bola Tinubu. The Independent National Electoral Commission asked the court for an order to redesign its bimodal voter accreditation system, or BVAS, that uses fingerprints and facial recognition, which was previously used for the presidential vote for governorship election. Obi and Atiku of the People's Democratic Party have said the result of the presidential election was fraudulent and vowed to challenge it in court. This is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinua Adofo in Washington. China has set an economic growth target of 5%. Analysts believe this is a modest figure, but Australian exporters are hoping that China will soon lift its trade restrictions and tariffs against one of its major trading partners in order to reach its growth targets. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
Analysts in Australia believe China's economy is in transition and is moving away from a focus on global trade to a model based on more consumer spending and internal investment. Beijing's annual growth target of 5% is considered by experts to be a modest goal. China accounts for about a third of Australia's global trade in goods and services. Government figures show this was worth $186 billion in 2021, up from $162 billion in 2020. But increased diplomatic tensions between the two countries led to the imposition of tariffs and other restrictions by China on some Australian exports, including coal, barley and wine. The centre-left government in Canberra has been working to ease political friction with Beijing, which has been caused by various disputes, including disagreements over the South China Sea and origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. Associate Professor Angela Knox of the University of Sydney's Business School believes China understands that it needs to nurture ties with countries such as Australia to meet its economic growth targets. But Knox told VOA that Australia is also working to diversify its global trade.
In Australia, we probably knew that we had a very heavy dependence on China. Diversification is always a good thing. We shouldn't be putting all of our eggs in one basket. So where there are opportunities to expand and diversify, we should certainly be taking those kinds of opportunities and building those opportunities.
Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has said that his country must foster economic links with other countries, including Indonesia and India. Albanese visits India this week, where he'll focus on the South Asian nation's rapid technological growth and expanding digital economy. But Australia remains heavily dependent on demand from China. Data from Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade has shown that in 2021, commerce with China was worth more than the combined value of its trading goods and services with Japan, the United States, and South Korea. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Thank you, Phil. As parts of southeast Turkey struggle to recover from last month's earthquake, many are questioning why so many relative modern buildings collapsed in the 7.8 magnitude tremor, with some engineers pointing the finger at government policy, as Henry Ridgewell reports.
A month on from the earthquake, piles of concrete and twisted metal tower over the roadsides in southeast Turkey's worst-hit towns and cities. Bodies are still buried inside. Millions of tons of debris are slowly being removed. But questions over the level of devastation are not going away. Survivors describe buildings liquefying as the tremors hit, each floor collapsing onto the next. Why did some buildings survive relatively unscathed while others collapsed? Hassan Aksungur is chairman of the Chamber of Civil Engineers in the city of Adana, close to the earthquake zone.
Geriye, onun yanındaki binaların yıkılmış olmaması, aynı...
He told VOA the fact that the buildings next to those collapsed buildings, which were exposed to the same impact, were not demolished, shows that either the design, the implementation, or the control stages of these collapsed buildings were broken. Critics of Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan say his government repeatedly offered amnesties for illegal buildings, what Erdogan called zoning peace, allowing builders to skip crucial safety regulations. Millions of buildings were certified in this way. Again, Hassan Aksungur. He said since 1985, there have been consecutive zoning amnesties. In the last zoning peace in 2018, these buildings were given a building registration certificate without being subject to any control, without being subject to anything, by paying certain fees. Before the earthquake hit, the government was mulling another building amnesty ahead of the May presidential election. Erdogan boasted of these amnesties during the 2019 election campaign, including on a visit to the province of Hatay, now one of the worst hit by the earthquake. At the time, Erdogan said, "We have solved the problems of 205,000 of the citizens of Hatay with zoning peace." The Turkish government has not responded to VOA requests for comment. Turkey's justice minister has highlighted that opposition parties also supported the building amnesties. And last month, President Erdogan accused rivals of exploiting the earthquake for political gain.
Birilerinin insanlarımızla birlikte...
He told lawmakers, "We know that some are rubbing their hands, waiting for the state and the government to fall under the ruins, along with our people." Erdogan has said the presidential election will go ahead in May. The earthquake response and what caused more than 45,000 people to lose their lives look set to be a key issue as the incumbent president seeks a third term in office. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News.
Season 3 of the Basketball Africa League is here. Starting off in Dakar from March 11th to March 21st for the Sahara Conference, then heading to Cairo from April 26th to May 6th for the Nile Conference, and the excitement continues to build in the finals in Kigali from May 21st to May 27th. Tune in and follow the BAL starting this Saturday on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel. In honor of Women's History Month, we feature distinguished public servant Alice P. Albright, the CEO of the Millennium Challenge Corporation. A unique U.S. foreign assistance agency, MCC was created nearly 20 years ago to fight poverty through economic growth. The daughter of former U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright talks about the impact of MCC from Africa to Asia. That's Press Conference USA this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and a panel of Washington journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including China warns the U.S. it should change its, quote, distorted, unquote, attitude towards them while defending its stance on the war in Ukraine and China's close ties to Russia. Join us for Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com. And check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition on our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Gina Duofo in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
1 year after Vladimir Putin's armies rolled into Ukraine to start a brutal war, the foreign ministers of the United States, Germany, and Ukraine sat down in Munich, Germany, for a question-and-answer conference regarding their vision of Ukraine's future. All three agreed that the war will end when Russia stops fighting and withdraws its troops. But the question is, how far should Russia's war machine withdraw before peace in Ukraine can begin? Does the war end once Russia withdraws its troops to pre-February 22 lines? Or do hostilities cease only after Putin's army pulls back to its position prior to the February 2014 invasion of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula? That is up to the Ukrainian people. We will support the decisions of our Ukrainian friends about the future of their country, said Secretary of State Antony Blinken. But any peace has to be consistent with the principles of the United Nations Charter.
It is fundamentally against the interests of every other country around the world to wind up with a result that somehow vindicates the seizure by force of territory, that validates that. Because if we do that, we will open a Pandora's box around the world, and every would-be aggressor will conclude that if Russia got away with it, we can get away with it. And that's not in anyone's interest because it's a recipe for a world of conflict.
What is in our common interest, said Secretary Blinken, is a just and durable peace.
We have to do everything in our power to make sure that Russia won't simply repeat the exercise a year, 5 years later. And among other things, that means making sure that Ukraine has the capacity to deter aggression and, if necessary, to effectively defend against it. So even as we're doing everything we can to provide Ukraine with the assistance it needs now to deal with the Russian aggression, we have to be thinking, and we are, about what the post-war future looks like to ensure that we have security and stability for Ukrainians and security and stability in Europe.
We have no doubt at all about Ukraine's victory and success. There is a simple, powerful reason for that, said Secretary Blinken. Irrespective of anything else, including the support we're providing, the biggest single difference is that Ukrainians are fighting for their own country, for their future, for their land. The Russians are not. And that will be the biggest difference maker.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.